Have you ever wanted to dive deeper into Scripture? If so, you're in luck, because every day there's a new Scripture reflection from the thoughtful staff at America Media, thinking through big questions together, like, what do Catholics believe about guardian angels? And what can Gen Zers take away from the Gospels? If you're already a subscriber, you can access these reflections in your email inbox or on our website. If you'd like to become a digital subscriber, it's easy to do. Just visit americamagazine.org/subscribe, and you'll have full access to America's Scripture Reflections.
Hello, and welcome to Jesuitical, a podcast from America Media for saints and sinners. You can join us each week for honest conversations about the Catholic Church and our world today, often over drinks. I'm Ashley McKinless, and I'm joined by Zach Davis.
It's great to be with you, Ashley.
We have a really exciting episode for Lent because we actually have it over drinks this time.
Yeah, that's right. This is a very, very Lenty episode. We're coming down to the home stretch in Lent. So I think we got Palm Sunday and Holy Week next week. So we wanted to revive one of our regular practices of the show, which is having something over drinks. But we didn't want to abandon our no alcohol on the show rule during Lent.
Yes. So we'll get to the specific drink we're having. But first, we want to introduce our guest because he's the one who introduced this drink to us. And that is Derek Brown. He is the founder of Positive Damage, Inc. and an expert on no and low alcohol cocktails and mindful drinking.
Yeah, I've been wanting to do an episode like this for a long time, both because I feel like there's been a huge rise in people reconsidering their relationship to alcohol. And we figured that was good practice on the show. You know, we certainly don't want to exclude people from the sharing our beverages around the podcast table. So Derek is someone who has a really fascinating story, both how he became Catholic, but also sort of his journey with alcohol and where he's landed in to what he now calls mindful drinking.
Yeah. And in our interview, you'll hear Derek talking about his time as a bartender. And he's pretty humble in our conversation. He's an award-winning cocktail mixologist. He has books on it. He had one of the like most popular, fanciest cocktail bars in D.C. called the Columbia Room. So I just didn't want to leave that out. But he went from that to making really fantastic low and no alcohol mocktails.
Yeah. And so we've got one of those today. And this required some you did all the work for this.
I did, yes. So it's called the Pinch Hitter. So it involves fresh lemon juice, ginger syrup, which I
it's you hard homemade.
To, it's hard yeah. to find. I couldn't find it at the grocery store or the liquor store. So I made some fresh ginger syrup, a bar spoon of apple cider vinegar, and 1/2 ounce aquafaba, which if you've never heard of that, I hadn't either, but it's basically the water that chickpeas come in when you buy canned chickpeas, plus 6 drops of salt tincture, which is basically salt water.
And so this came out of Derek's book, Mindful Mixology, A Comprehensive Guide to No and Low Alcohol Cocktails. So definitely check that out. Cheers. Let's give this a try.
All right.
That is fascinating.
Yeah. My mouth is a little like, it's definitely like puckered.
Yeah.
Tastes the lemon, but it's also sweeter than I was expecting. You really taste the ginger syrup coming through.
And the chickpea juice, which I was the like most skeptical of. Yeah. I feel like that's adding some body and savoriness mm-hmm. to it. So you're hitting like salty, sweet, acid, savory all in one drink. So
yeah.
Two thumbs
all right.
up.
Thanks, Derek.
So we're not doing Signs of the Times this week because we're traveling back from Los Angeles during our normal recording time. Also, Derek's conversation is pretty spiritually deep, so we're going to skip our face-sharing segment at the end because we think there's a lot of good stuff there in the interview.
Yeah, so stick around for that conversation. But first, we have some words from our sponsor this week.
Are you searching for a meaningful way to get closer with Jesus this Lent? Let me introduce you to a fantastic opportunity, Daily Rosary Meditations with Dr. Mike Scherslick.
Their podcast is quickly gaining popularity, offering daily reflections on the Catholic faith through the Rosary. Each day, Dr. Mike dives into a different topic, guiding listeners in meditation while praying the Rosary alongside a global community.
In just under 20 minutes, you'll experience scripture, meditation, and the Rosary, all designed to fit seamlessly into your daily routine. Whether it's during your morning coffee or your daily commute, it's a wonderful chance to start your day with faith and reflection.
And you can find it easily on your favorite podcast app by searching Daily Rosary Meditations or visiting their website at dailyrosary.net. Don't miss this chance to enrich your Lenten journey and strengthen your relationship with God. Join them on Daily Rosary Meditation today. And now stick around for our conversation with Derek Brown about mindful drinking. Joining us in Washington, D.C. is Derek Brown. Derek is the founder of Positive Damage, Inc. and an expert on no and low alcohol cocktails and mindful drinking. Welcome to Jesuitical, Derek.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for including me.
Yeah, it's been great to get to know you a little bit. We've been wanting to do this interview for a long time. You had an article with America back in 2020. Something happened then that derailed lots of plans.
Yes,
but
yes.
Wanted to start with a story there because you talk about the first cocktail you ever made.
And it sounds like the kind of thing I would make for Jesuitical.
It's true.
I'm a notoriously bad. Well, yeah, I'll let you describe the cocktail
but
first.
Yeah, typically on the podcast, we're trying to recreate conversations that you might have with friends over drinks. And so to do that, we usually pour ourselves a drink.
Right.
It's Lent, so we're not doing that with you right now. But Ashley is the, I would say the, how would you put it? The more economical bartender of the two of us.
Yes, so my notorious story is we were having Irish coffee and he used Folgers instant coffee.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And Jim Beam.
And you microwave the water. Yeah. So
okay.
Got a lot of listener mail after that. But this, your first cocktail was not quite that bad, but it was in that vein.
Oh, no, it was bad. I think it's very, there's not much lower that you can get in terms of complexity, taste, just general, like, you know, is this a reasonable drink to have? You know, it wasn't. It was called an alien secretion.
Okay. And this was like a recipe. You didn't just make it up.
Yeah. So, So I didn't know how to make cocktails at all. Nothing. So I went into, I think it was like a, it probably was like a Barnes and Noble or something. And I picked out a book that said like 1,000 cocktails, right? You know right there that it's going to go wrong because there's no way that you can just list out 1,000 cocktails and every recipe is going to be good. So, and I just like flipped through the pages and everything looked so confusing to me because I didn't really know how to measure a cocktail. I didn't know what these ingredients were, you know? And so what I did was I settled on this page for a drink that had equal parts. Because I know what an equal part is. That's really easy, right?
Yeah.
It was equal parts Captain Morgan's spiced rum or spiced rum, you know, but that was the one at the time. Midori melon liquor, that bright green bottle,
which
is actually better than you think it is, but in this case, not so good. And canned pineapple juice, you know, which actually I tried it with fresh pineapple juice at one point to try to improve it. It actually makes it even worse. So the three of those ingredients together.
There's some people listening right now that are like,
that sounds good.
Yeah. Like my mom and mother-in-law, I think, would, if they heard you describing that, would be like, yes, that sounds right up my alley.
Well, I mean, you know, okay, there you go. Now you have everything you need to go make that cocktail.
And was this in the context of a frat party?
No. It was my friend's birthday, and I wanted to like make a cocktail for him. I thought that was like a big deal, you know? So I did, and it was bright green. And I made it in a pitcher. Right? I don't know.
As like, most good cocktails are made.
Yeah, but see, I was born in the 70s. And so when I grew up, there's this pitcher that I think every household had. You know, it was like the plastic pitcher that had like this thing that you turn, slotted.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, yeah.
And so I made it in that. And I took ice from the freezer and just like dumped it in and put that. And I doubt I stirred it. I actually really don't remember. Maybe I just kind of like what I call chicken winged it, where you just like take your arm. Folks, you can't see that, but I'm just doing an elbow move. So it was bad. It was very bad. And it.
Did you know it was bad at the time? Like you tasted it and you're like, ew, or at the time where you're like, oh, this is pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. It tasted. I mean, the nicest thing to say about it is that it tasted like sour candy.
Zach loves sour candy.
Usually in my cocktails, but I do love sour candies.
Yeah.
But you didn't stop there.
No. And let me just be clear about that one. There were some, and the reason I brought that to the article, and maybe I'm jumping to the punchline, but it was great, you know, because I got this opportunity to share this experience with my friend. Now we did overindulge, and it was definitely not, you know, like a great morning the next day, even for young people.
That amount of sugar is
right. Yeah.
But the experience of just like connecting with somebody over a drink, I just think is a wonderful thing. And so it doesn't really matter. Look, I mean, now I make super fancy cocktails. Like, I just opened a cocktail bar as a beverage director in LA, and some of the cocktails are like $22, right? And so I think for some people, that's an extreme amount of money. For other people, that's just kind of normal. It really depends who you are and where you live. But that's fancy. The level of detail we put into it. But whether you're enjoying that cocktail or you're enjoying the alien secretion, what does it matter? Like, ultimately, it's about the people that you connect to and the relationships you have with them, you know? And so that's what I think is most meaningful about that. So bad cocktail, good experience.
Mm. Okay. And so fast forward from there, you became an award-winning bartender. So how did you decide to go into that line of work? And, you know, when you're at the height of your game, what was life like for you?
Yeah, I think that the reason I got into it was a little different why I stayed into it. But really, at one point, I just was at a point in my life where I wasn't happy with where I was at. I was kind of like floating in life. I wasn't really doing anything. I sometimes refer to myself as a shiftless loser at that point. You know? it wasn't necessarily a bad thing because I was younger and it was the right time to do that. But I decided I really wanted to do something. And this was right in front of me. I had the opportunity to bartend. I was working in a restaurant. Rocky, the owner, she was like, "Hey, do you know how to bartend?" And I said, "Yeah." I did not, but I had made a cocktail, right? I knew how to make one cocktail at least. And because they had just lost a bartender at this restaurant. It's called Rocky's Cafe in Adams Morgan. And so she's, "Hey, you go ahead, you can start." And for the first night, the first person who came in, I was so worried because I had no idea what I was going to make for them, right? Because I knew how to make one drink and they didn't even have those ingredients there. So this person like came in and was like, "I'll take a vodka soda." And I was like, "Oh, God." Whew. You know, like vodka, soda, that is obvious in the name. So yeah. Fast forward a little bit, and it really fit like a glove because there's so many elements of it that I enjoyed. The social element, connecting with all these people around me, the creativity that went behind it, that it was really active and fun. You know, like there's so many things that why it was such a good profession for me at the time. And I had been working in restaurants since I was 16 years old. So I already had like a basis knowledge of hospitality and the basics. And so I decided somebody is the best bartender in the world. And I have no idea who it is, but I don't know why it shouldn't be me. And that's what started me on the path. Now, let's be very clear. I am absolutely not and have never been the best bartender in the world. But it's like one of those things where you shoot for the moon and you end up among the stars. You know, like I definitely have, you know, made a reputation for myself and a name for myself in bartending. And, you know, I learned a lot about it. You know, I just have a very kind of inquisitive mind. And so I started really delving into the history of it, all of the, you know, science of it, every aspect of making a cocktail. So it wasn't just about the drink to me. It was about everything that went into it. And so as I went along, I was rewarded for that. I started writing for Atlantic Magazine on cocktails. Later on, I would become the chief spirits advisor to the National Archives, which is kind of a made-up position.
Yeah, I was going
to
say,
amazing. Yeah. But, have you vacated that?
I'm no longer, which also made me the highest ranking bartender in the U.S. government, I guess. So I think that like at some point, I just kind of also realized that even though alcohol was this really wonderful thing in my life, it was also this thing that had caused a lot of problems for me too. So sometime in my like late 30s, I'm 49 now, I had to sort of start dealing with that. I had to start dealing with the fact that alcohol was no longer serving me the way that it had. And I came to a real head and I had to really make a decision. And I thought, okay, well, I can't really drink the way that I did anymore. So maybe I can't be in bars the way I was anymore. So I thought, what am I going to do? Like real estate? Like I'm going to choose another job? Podcasting? We'll get to that. Then I had to, you know, kind of like figure it out. So I started talking to people and I addressed aspects of my mental health. I addressed drinking in a more holistic way. And I thought, okay, well, what am I going to do now? And at that point, that's when I made the decision that I could do exactly the same thing that I was doing. But now I could focus instead on no and low alcohol cocktails. And I could change the focus a little bit to incorporate my own experience now and what I wanted to share with other people.
Can we go back to this moment of fear? Because I think anytime there's any kind of conversion happening, there's a fear of what's on the other side. I mean, anybody who has a relationship with alcohol to all of a sudden be faced with, wait, maybe I can't do this anymore. Like, so much of life is centered around alcohol for a lot of people, whether it's, you know, happy hours or dinner or family events. There's usually someone handing out drinks. And all of a sudden, if you can't participate in that, that scares a lot of people. But for you, it was also wrapped up in your career.
Yeah.
I mean, could you say something about how you were feeling about whether or not this was like a path you needed to go down?
Yeah.
Was this did this gradually come to you, or?
There was some gradual elements to it, but ultimately, and you know, when I talk about the fact that I had addressed my relationship with alcohol, there's a great deal of pain and time in that, you know? So I don't want to just skip over that, like, oh yeah, then I addressed it, blah, 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 now I'm great. I mean, I had to really look at my mental health. I actually ended up getting into therapy, and I went into an outpatient program for dual diagnosis and bipolar disorder and alcohol use disorder. And so those were very serious moments of my life where I had to address who I was. Mm. So I don't want to just like, bah, 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 you know, skip over that. Yeah. But I also don't want to, you know, do some trauma dumping here either. We're good. You know, like I dealt with it. But when I got to that point where I had to make a choice, I was really scared. And I was really scared because my identity was wrapped around alcohol. I used to joke that without alcohol, I wouldn't have hobbies, friends, or a job. You know, and that was true. And so the moment when I was telling my friends, who would always tell, like, hey, let's go drinking, let's go do this thing, you know, and alcohol was at the center of it, and I had to tell them, I can't do this anymore, it was really hard. And I wasn't sure how they would respond. Right? Because some of the relationships that I had formed were so enmeshed in alcohol that it was hard to imagine pulling them apart and everything survives. So I did that. And I remember a conversation I had with my partners that were a part of the bars. At that time, I think I had 5 bars. And I was like, y'all, I can't show up like I have been showing up, and I might not be able to be the same person that I was. And they were all just incredibly kind about it. And the fact that, like, I started having those conversations with my family, with my friends, with my partners that I work with, and everybody was so kind about it that I was really, I thought to myself, first of all, I've made good decisions in the relationships that I've formed, regardless of the alcohol component. And I know that not everybody's going to have that reaction, but I did have that reaction, but I wasn't sure that I would. And when it happened, it really made me realize that this is the right path for me for so many reasons, because now everything is pushing toward that direction. I had one conversation with an investor in the bars that I had, and he had kind of separated himself from the bars. He didn't show up as often. He wasn't calling as often. And I had to, you know, I was talking to him when I ended up closing the bars, and I went out to see him, and I started talking to him about this. And he said, I know. You didn't have to tell me. I already knew that you were in trouble, but I didn't know how to help you. I didn't know how to intervene. And so I didn't want to watch you kill yourself. And that was a really powerful moment, because I realized that I was affecting everybody around me. It wasn't just me that it was being affected. It was everyone around me. And that change that I made was critical to myself, but also for the relationships that I had.
Yeah. Can you talk about what was on the other side in terms of your relationship, your health, just how your life changed?
Yeah. Everything was perfect after that. Everything ideal and you know, it was lovely. So, no, it's really funny, because if you are following anything about the new changes that are happening within drinking, you know, a lot of people are making changes around alcohol, mindful drinking, sober curiosity, sober-ish, you know, dry January, all these things are coming up and people are starting. If you were to read the articles, you would believe that everything changes, that your skin is better, that your sleep is better, that your relationships are better, everything, just a whole list. And some of those things may be statistically true. You know, there might be studies to suggest that it improves your sleep, you know, but it really doesn't happen like that. For me, what happened instead is that a door was opened and I could look at my life more accurately. I could be more real about my life, because before, alcohol was a way for me, and drugs was a way of hiding that. it was a medicine of sorts to try to protect me from looking at myself, which I was not happy with myself and I was not happy with who I was. Even though I was winning all these awards and accolades for bartending, I had these bars, I wasn't the person that I, the best person I could have been. And so the gift of, you know, changing my relationship with alcohol was not a perfect, peaceful, wonderful life. It was an opportunity to look at myself in the mirror and see me for who I am. And so that, mm-hmm. I think, is such a beautiful gift. And it's a hard gift.
Yeah. You have it. I was reading your Substack and you had this line that jumped out to me, that alcohol is important to civilization and also unhealthy for us as individuals. So it seems like you've explained how it can be unhealthy for individuals. How is it important for civilization? And if the trend is going away from drinking, what does that mean for our social lives?
Right. And I don't have to really say this to Catholics, right? At the end of the day, alcohol is kind of a big part of what
we're not
do.
You know, generally pro.
I mean, and if you're showing up on Sundays, obviously it's not always compulsory, but it's generally part of it. So I think we understand that part. But when we go really back to the earliest human endeavors, even religious gatherings, right? You'll see that alcohol is a component of that. If you go back to agriculture, which is the beginning of the type of civilization that we have, alcohol is there. I think it's become more known, but I don't know if you know this, but there's this debate in anthropology and archaeology about what came first, bread or beer, because both are similar processes. Right. But it's super unlikely that humans would get together and spend so much effort for a loaf of bread. You know what I mean? So as lovely as bread can be, chances are that agriculture and the beginning of organized agriculture was because of alcohol. So alcohol is not, when I say it's important to our civilization, I mean, it is what helped create our civilizations. And it's so part of our evolution, you know, like it's tied to humans in an evolutionary way. And so I think, you know, we can't really easily extricate it and say like, oh, it's no longer important. But as you said, you know, and I was sharing my own relationship to alcohol, it can be challenging for individuals. And so we have to kind of make that decision as a civilization, as a people, as a group, like how we deal with that. And we've made some really bad decisions around that in the past, including banning it outright, which never really seems to work.
Yeah, so the reevaluation that people are going through around their relationship to drinking, is that happening sort of serendipitously at the same time you're reevaluating your own relationship to alcohol?
I was wondering, is it tied to the pandemic? Because I know for a lot of people, that year of isolation kind of made them realize where the place of alcohol in their lives.
Well, especially if, I think drinking, because it's a social thing, if all of a sudden you have to drink by yourself, it's, you know, it's a Zoom happy hour, just doesn't hit quite the same way.
That's right, yeah.
You know?
That's exactly right. And I think that when people went through this experience that they had to, you know, look more at their lives, because I guess in a sense we were faced with this, you know, impending doom and death. You know, like we were, you know, it was a collective memento mori, you know, like where we're just like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
And I remember like in the early days of it, like trying to spray bleach solution on my groceries. Like, I mean, it got weird.
Just pour alien secretion on it. I'm sure it'll get rid of any germs.
And then, so what role does alcohol have in that? You know, we saw that a lot of people came out of that drinking more. That has led to a lot of problems. And because that was a way of coping with the boredom, the isolation. And so I think that those are really bad reasons to drink. So for myself, that was part of the change, as I started looking more deeply into what I wanted to do in life, what I wanted to achieve. And I think a lot of people did too. And so there was this growing movement that actually started a little bit before that, but definitely gained momentum after the pandemic. But I want to actually insert something historical about that as well, is one of the largest social movements in the history of the United States, and in fact, a big part of, you know, Europe too, is temperance. And temperance was the you know, mindful drinking 1.0. And that was what eventually got hijacked by zealots and turned into prohibition.
Oh, I associate those two together. That temperance meant you can't have any at all. So that is historically not the case?
That's not the case. The earliest advocates of that, like the signer of the Declaration of Independence, the only physician to do so, Dr. Benjamin Rush, was an early proponent of temperance and talked about, he has this, something called the moral thermometer. And it talked about drinking, and like it had literally a thermometer. And what happens if you drink small beer and like wine, you know, you're cool, you're fine. If you go down and you start drinking gin punch, that like leads to death, ruin, all this stuff, you know? So he's wrong, you know, because you can get drunk off of any alcohol. But ultimately, you know, he was trying to make a distinguishing drinking for social reasons and maybe drinking something that was lower in alcohol by volume or ABV. In the mid 19th century, Abraham Lincoln gave a speech at Springfield in which he talked about temperance, and he called it the Second American Revolution. And so, you know, this has been a big part of American life. And originally it was to reduce drinking, but let me explain why they needed to reduce drinking. In the early part of a colonial America, we drank 7.1 gallons of pure alcohol per person a year. So just so you know, that's a tremendous amount. What we drink right now is around 2.3 gallons per person, which is also not great. That's the same amount we are drinking in the 1860s. Hmm. So it's kind of gone back up. But they were responding to a real issue that was happening. You know, Americans in the colonial days were like drunk all the time. I mean, I don't want to exaggerate. They weren't like falling down, but they were drinking a lot. And that was a normal part of their lives. And so those changes had to be made. And so temperance was a response to that. And then it got hijacked by zealots and turned into prohibition. And I think that's hard to imagine in America that zealots would take over and hijack anything.
It's not really part of our fabric at all.
Yeah, but it happened.
I am curious about, you know, historically, there's, you know, been a debate whether temperance or total sobriety. What was that decision like in your own life? Because I'm sure the obvious door to your right is, you know, stone cold sober, don't touch it ever again. How did you come to a place where you're like, I can do this, just not as much as I used to?
Well, I just like flip-flop back and forth between like, you know, drinking a lot and drinking nothing, you know? Mm-hmm. And for some reason I thought that was okay. But the reason why mindful drinking became important for me is because I realized that although I had alcohol use disorder, it wasn't something that was going to stay with me for life. So alcohol use disorder, let me just clarify, is moderate, mild, and severe, you know, that there are different levels of it. And we refer to, in a colloquial way, we refer to alcohol use disorder as alcoholism, right? But that's not the medical terminology. That's just what's used in, you know, AA groups and so forth. So if you're referring to alcoholism, usually you think, oh, that's it. That's the end. You have to, you know, show up in a basement and drink bad coffee for the rest of your life. And for some people that works. Yeah. So I don't want to like say that's bad. It's definitely not. It's really good for some people. But for other people, there's a way that they can address it, you know, like for me, through therapy, through therapeutic drugs, through taking time away from it, and then coming back to it and realizing it's okay. Now, I want to be really careful there. I think each person, if they feel that they have a problem with alcohol, should not go, great, Derek said I could eventually drink again. That's cool, right? Everybody is different. And so I really recommend that people talk to a therapist, to their primary physician, to a nurse, to somebody, in them, even a peer who has experience with this, to really understand their relationship with alcohol. But for me, I was able to say, you know what? I don't have that compulsion to drink all the time. So I can drink a little bit. And so I did that for a while, actually, that I had like maybe one or two drinks a month. Now I don't drink at all. And it's mostly because I'm so excited about this new world of non-alcoholic drinks that I really revel in that and I'm enjoying all that and I don't feel like I need to.
Are there like pillars of mindful drinking that you can describe, or is it just drink less.
Yeah, drink less. No, actually, funny enough, mindful drinking is not about abstinence or even moderation in a way. Although I think implicit it is kind of moderation. But the idea is that you make the choice for yourself. And so, again, it's not associated with recovery and somebody who has severe alcohol use disorder and needs to, you know, medical advice for that. Mindful drinking is for most of the people who have, you know, whether it's through peer pressure or through habit or just, you know, general conformity, are drinking all the time and it's not something they intend to do. Mm-hmm. So mindful drinking is about them kind of making that choice and saying, okay, I'm really going to think about my goals and alcohol in relationship to those goals. And do they fit together?
You mentioned in the article for America this distinction G.K. Chesterton makes between irrational and rational drinking. And weirdly enough, irrational is the better way. So how does that comport with – how can you be both irrational about drinking and mindful?
It's classic Chesterton, too.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a little bit of rhetoric there that we don't really need to, like, parse through too much, you know. I mean, I think that what's important to pull from that is the necessity to drink, the necessity to drink.
So rational drinking is the need to drink. Irrational drinking is because you want to be with your
friend.
And
he uses some funny, strange, you know, imagery from there of like the happy drunk in the, you know.
Like an Italian village or something. Yeah.
And all of this is just more poetic than, you know. But I think, but his distinction is really great.
Yeah, because it gets to the motivation for drinking.
Exactly.
Right?
And so necessity can show up as just like you go out to a happy hour, you know, you're with work friends, everybody's looking at you. And you go to order a drink and you're like, I need to order something that won't make me look like a fool. You know, I don't want to be embarrassed. Then you go ahead and you order. Oh, they order Manhattan. I'll order Manhattan. Next thing you know, that's literally almost two drinks in one in terms of the alcohol amount, you know. And so you drink that and then you start having some fun, start having relaxing. You drink another drink. You're three or four drinks in and you never intended to. The next day, you're wrecked. You have some sort of brain fog around it. You feel nauseous, all of that stuff. You know, a hangover can show up for people, even in some cases, with just one drink. Mm-hmm. And so I think that we need to make the choice for ourselves what we drink in relationship to our goals. That's essentially what mindful drinking is. So in that moment, right, I want to empower people to make the decision. I don't want to tell them not to drink if that's what their goal is and that's they feel all right. Maybe they've already set aside that space. Maybe they enjoy drinks. They want to have a couple. Totally fine. Totally reasonable. But for somebody who is questioning their relationship or they don't want to do that, I don't want them to feel like it's compulsory, like they get pulled into it. So by offering non-alcoholic drinks, by giving them simple tools and strategies they can use going into that event, that's what I try to do as somebody who promotes mindful drinking.
Could we go through the options that are more and more available nowadays? Because non-alcoholic cocktails actually make the most sense to me because I see a lot of people ordering Heineken Zeros, which is fine, but that sounds like it's going to taste terrible.
It tastes a lot like Heineken.
Yeah, exactly. And like a non-alcoholic wine, it's a complicated process where you have to take the alcohol out of the wine in the first place. But cocktails feels like a natural place to land there. So could you just make maybe the case for why someone should spend maybe up to $22 on a non-alcoholic cocktail?
Yeah. Well, I'll start by saying there is no case I can make for somebody who believes that it's a dollar per buzz, right? So if they believe that the idea is that you get buzzed off these drinks, right, and you feel in a different space, then these won't do that for the most part. There are quote unquote functional ingredients, right? These are ingredients that have health supporting properties. They might be like B vitamins or CBD or stuff like that. But ultimately, alcohol has a very immediate effect. And if you're looking for that effect, then I can't make the case. But if you're looking for taste, flavor, and the sociality around it, then I think it's very obvious. The same care goes into the drink. Sometimes the ingredients are even more expensive. Because imagine you're talking about the wine and mm-hmm. the alcohol removal process. Well, that happens in some quote unquote non-alcoholic spirits too. Mm. They will go through and they will produce this non-alcoholic spirit at a greater expense to them because it's harder to make and they need more ingredients to do it. All these different reasons. So so ultimately it might even cost more money. So just in terms of the cost to the bar or to the bartender, it's the same, or sometimes even more.
That's important because I feel like consumers go, what? There's not even any liquor in this.
Yeah, exactly.
Why am I paying just as much? But, you know, part of the fun of alcohol is if you go to a cocktail bar and everyone passes around and like, oh, let me try yours. And if you get one of these non-alcoholic cocktails that has gone through the same care, you can still participate in that. It seems like a ton of sense to me.
A lot of the positive emotions that we associate with alcohol are just from the experience of tasting something delicious and interesting, from being together with other people. Remember that moment of my alien secretion, you know, like,
yeah.
It turns out that the actual alcohol was not necessary for me to enjoy myself. I could have had a great time and made something delicious. So I think that a lot of the positive emotions that we associate with alcohol aren't necessarily from it. We give alcohol too much credit. You know, some people will be like, oh, $22 for a cocktail. That's crazy, you know. And I do admit that that's pretty intense, you know. But at the same time, they'll pay $22 for an appetizer at a restaurant. And that doesn't have any alcohol in it, you know. So, ooh, is it only alcohol? No. I mean, we want more than just alcohol in our lives. And for many of us, alcohol isn't really even important to that experience. We can get so much out of it without it. So I guess what I'm suggesting is, yeah, non-alcoholic cocktails are a great way that you can, you know, like if you're going out and you want to feel like part of the group and you want to enjoy yourself, you want to have an experience that feels adult and sophisticated, then you can get a non-alcoholic cocktails. And I hope that more bars, restaurants, hotels, et cetera, will adopt these non-alcoholic drinks. Other than that, I think I suggest a couple of different ways that people can approach drinking mindfully if they feel like they need a little support. I have an acronym for that, which is replace, avoid, temper, and elicit, or rate, as in the rate in which you drink, right? And replace is obvious. Replace it with non-alcoholic drinks. There are also things, if you go to a place that doesn't have non-alcoholic drinks and you kind of feel like you don't want to explain your whole life story just because you're not drinking, because that happens sometimes, mm-hmm. right? You say, oh, I'll have a soda water. People go, oh, are you pregnant? Oh, are you an alcoholic? Oh, you know, like they want you to explain, and maybe you don't want to really tell your whole life story to somebody mm-hmm. in that moment. So what I suggest is doing something called propping, which is just getting a drink that looks like a gin and tonic. Get a tonic with a lime and a short stout glass and walk around with that. Somebody says, oh, do you need a drink? Got one. You don't have to lie to anybody. You have something that looks and feels part. And actually, you know, sometimes you just feel weird not knowing what to do with your hands. So I get it. As far as avoiding, I think that's obvious. You know, sometimes there are places that we go that will trigger us to drink in a certain way. For some people, like karaoke, right? Like they'll go to karaoke and they feel like—
can't help myself.
Exactly. They feel like they need that liquid courage. And so maybe avoiding that event and going to something else, if you're going on a date, for instance, you know, and alcohol seems like a prerequisite to that, maybe go to a climbing gym instead. Maybe go to something else that would, or a movie that doesn't have alcohol, because now movie theaters have alcohol a lot more. Things like that are ways to avoid it too. Temper is by drinking low alcohol drinks, or even doing something called tempo drinking, which is switching back and forth between no and low alcohol drinks, right? So maybe start with a no alcohol drink, have a drink with alcohol, and then go back and forth. I think that's a really wonderful way to do it if you usually drink alcohol, because then you're not really ever out of the action, but you're not drinking four or five drinks with alcohol in a row. And then elicit help is really just having maybe like a buddy that you go with, that you check in with, and you say, all right, I only intend to have two drinks. That's my goal. So if the person sees you on the third drink, you know, instead of coming running over and knocking it out of your hands, says, hey, I just want to check in. How are you feeling? Should we go home? Are we good here? Should we try someplace else? You know, just having that connection can really help.
Someone on your side, when someone else is like, let's get shots, you can have another person being like, that's a terrible idea.
Right. And there's even apps that help with cataloging the way you drink. So that's another way. But yeah, so that's the acronym that I use and the simple strategies that I use. There's a lot more, but that's my approach.
Curious if your faith has come into this, because a lot of the principles of mindful drinking also sound very Christian, you know, temperance, moderation, mm-hmm. et cetera. And in the Peace for America, we haven't touched on this too much, but you talk about sort of your own coming back to your Catholic faith as when you were bartending and meeting with Father Bill Daly.
Yeah, my faith absolutely informs this. And Christian values are a big part of that, especially derived from Catholicism. I mean, I think that it doesn't just involve the way that I approach mindful drinking. It's the reason I'm doing this, right? Because at the heart of it, when I wake up every morning, I say, oh, I don't want to do this. I don't want to, you know, like, I want to just go into a more lucrative line of work, or I want to do something else. You know, there's a lot you can do with alcohol that's probably better in terms of a financial benefit. But I think this is what I'm called to do. This is my, you know, calling. This is my way of adding something into the world. I have a really unique experience in life. You know, alcohol has been present throughout my entire life. You know, my father is a self-described alcoholic. I had a sister who died when I was 5 years old in a drunk driving accident. I've been at the top of bartenders, you know, like all of this. I've had the highs and the lows from alcohol. And so I really have, I think, a unique perspective. And I think that the reason I have that is so that I can share with people how we can drink and how we can incorporate in a way that we live healthy lifestyles, you know, because alcohol is not healthy for you. There's no amount that's healthy for you, but you can live a healthy life that incorporates alcohol. And so that's my calling, and faith is definitely at the center of that.
There's a trope that people treat their bartenders like their confessor or their therapist. I imagine you experienced that in your many years as a bartender. I'm wondering, is that something you miss, and is it something you're experiencing in a new way now that you're on this journey of mindful drinking?
Right. 1,000%, I do not miss that.
confessions don't sound as deep as we think they do when we're...
No, whenever I confess, I feel bad for the priest. I'm like, you have to listen to all this stuff. This is terrible. I think that, you know, I never enjoyed the emotional labor that it takes to listen to drunk people talk about their lives.
Yeah.
It's terrible, especially when they talk about changing their lives. Mm-hmm. That's really hard when you see them in a pit and you know you can't pull them out. You know, you can feel really actually a lot of pity for that situation. But now the type of people who reach out to me are people who are changing their relationship to alcohol, and they're usually sober or mindful in their drinking. And that connection is so much better. I used to encounter a lot more people and have a lot more conversations, but the conversations that I have now and the people I encounter are less. They're just much more meaningful. And so I think that when I removed alcohol, I didn't realize that that was going to happen. And when I stepped outside of bars, I didn't realize that was going to happen, that it did actually give me a chance to have a deeper connection with people. I think that there's a place for alcohol, clearly in that article, to start a conversation and to be a really important part of it. It's just sometimes when it goes over the edge, it becomes just gibberish and nonsense. So there is like a window in which it's a really important part of a conversation. And then there's another part of it where, you know, because alcohol is essentially biphasic, right? You have one part of it where you're kind of feel a little bit more uplifted and connected. And then there's another part where you're falling on your face. So I think, you know, distinguishing between those two is very important. The kind of conversations you have.
Derek, this has been a ton of fun. I've learned a ton. Before we let you go, we have one final question for you. We ask all our guests this. If you could canonize one person, living or dead, Catholic or not, fictional or real, who would it be and why?
I mean, I suppose that this is skirting it a little bit, but I just feel like maybe the idea of the bartender itself, you know, this person who is always there to listen to our problems, to pour us a drink, to, you know, like this idealized bartender. I don't want to pick out one because I have to admit, I don't really know any bartenders who are saints. But I just think that what bartenders do over and over again is actually really important in our world. And so I'm just going to say the bartender.
I think that could become a new like category of saint. You know, we'll have like so-and-so the martyr, so-and-so the confessor, so-and-so the bartender. I think that's the future.
That's perfect. And who is the patron saint of bartenders? I never asked that question.
How do we not know that?
It's probably the same as the patron saint of brewers, I'm sure.
Saint
Amand. So,
already canonized.
So. Already canonized. So we'll have to look that up. Derek, if listeners enjoyed hearing your perspective on stuff, where could they continue listening to that?
Yeah, if they enjoyed hearing me, then I have a new podcast that's with the NASM podcast network, and it's called The Mindful Drinking Podcast. And so you can get that on whatever platform you usually get your podcasts, including the one you're listening to this on. Please, I would love for you to tune in.
Awesome. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you both.
And now it's time for your parish announcements, the part of our show where we ask you to please be seated before the final blessing. Just a couple quick ones this week. We have a new bonus episode in our Patreon feed talking about the history of conclaves. So that's how we elect our popes. You would think that we've been doing it the same way for 1,000 years, but that's not really true. We've been doing it the same way for a while. But Francis's anniversary of being elected was this month, so thought we would talk to someone who knows the history of it, because people are obviously starting to look forward on that, as we talked about on last week's show. So that's really great. If you want to get that episode, you can sign up, support the show at patreon.com/AmericaMedia.
I'll get us out of here. Jesuitical is produced by Sebastian Gomes, with production assistance from Michael O'Brien, Delaney Coyne, and Kevin Christopher Robles, who's also our sound engineer. Faith formation provided by Father Eric Sundrup. You can find us on X and Instagram at Jesuitical Show. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/Jesuitical. Please subscribe wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and if you're on Apple or Spotify, leave us a review. Jesuitical is recorded in the William J. Loschert Studio at American Media in New York City. For American Media, I'm Ashley McKinless with Zach Davis. We'll see you next week.
Have you ever wanted to dive deeper into Scripture? If so, you're in luck, because every day there's a new Scripture reflection from the thoughtful staff at America Media, thinking through big questions together, like, what do Catholics believe about guardian angels? And what can Gen Zers take away from the Gospels? If you're already a subscriber, you can access these reflections in your email inbox or on our website. If you'd like to become a digital subscriber, it's easy to do. Just visit americamagazine.org/subscribe, and you'll have full access to America's Scripture Reflections.